of a state.
Yeah.
So,
Okay. Are you there? Christine, I've lost you.
back.
You're
Hey.
back. So just as we were going live, you just decided to freeze on me, which,
I
just
know.
really
I'm fine.
shocked everyone who's watching this show. But you're back, which is great to hear. Okay, so you're saying basically on the there's road traffic there essentially.
Yeah, road traffic, people, and I think it's just the way it's structured. So when people speak really loudly, it just echoes.
Oh wow. Yeah.
London
So
life, eh?
London life. Christine, by the way, has moved to a new house and she's complaining about the noise. Okay, everybody. Welcome. We are live, folks. Welcome to Brain Food Live on Air. It's episode 76, bringing it to you every Friday. I'm super excited today because we've not only got an amazing topic that I really want to dive into, which I think is super relevant and valuable for everyone really paying attention to anything brain food related. But once again, we've upgraded Adam Gordon. That's 2 weeks in a row. So sort it out. We've got Christine Ng, who's going to step in and be co-host with us. That's a significant upgrade. But before we kick off the show, as ever, no, before we do that, we need to do some AV checks, don't we? So once again, we're broadcasting this on Crowdcast. So people on Crowdcast, if you can hear me, just say hi, please, on the chat stream. I think you can, but I need to have that confirmed. So just say hello. For the folks who are paying attention on LinkedIn Live, I think I'm live there, but I'm not sure because I can't see it. Can you just please say yes, Hung? I can hear you. You're live there. You're okay. I've got actually a cool little chat app, which I think I can respond to you via that now. So if you do that, I'll be able to chat with you. And for the folks on Facebook group, have I gone live there? I hope I have. Yes, I have. So yeah, if you can hear me on Facebook and you're watching, just say hello, give me a like or a comment or something like that. Let me know. I'm all good there. I'm gonna get out Periscope because I think there's only three people that watch it there. but if you're there, give me a retweet. Anyway, okay, so this episode is sponsored by our friends at Brick. Brick are a blind screening tool that's going to help you do two things. It's going to help you find the people who can do the job with the skills-based testing, and also find the people who want to do your job with the personality the testing function also. Those are the two questions really we need to answer when you're ever dealing with applicants or candidates. So I think Brick is a very interesting tool, totally aligned with what we're doing today. How do you de-bias the recruiting process? And one of the big things that we can do really is focus on the suitability and competency of the person rather than look at the biographical data, which is often the big part of the problem there. So let me quickly share with you the Brick homepage. By the way, they can go ahead and you can sign up. And by the way, have a 14-day free trial on Brick with no demo. So go ahead and use it. Proof of the pudding is right there. Okay. So let's kick off with this topic. Christine, welcome to the show. You've been on here before. Everyone knows who you are, but maybe you can quickly introduce yourself to the few people who don't know you. Who are you and what do you do, Christine?
Sure, really flat to be here. Thanks. Thanks for the invite, Hung. So currently I'm working at the Financial Times, so global financial newspaper. I run recruitment for all things product and technology. So I've been there for now 2.5 years. Last time I was on the show, I was on furlough. Luckily, I'm now back in the office and I've since worked with the editorial team. I'm actually now back in product and tech. So yeah, really interesting times this year, I think, for us in recruitment, having to learn about, L&D and other areas outside of just day-to-day recruiting, really.
Yeah, cool. And actually, I think some of your recent work with the editorial side was related to D&I and all that type of stuff. So that'd be quite cool to explore as well. But before we dive into that, let's talk very quickly about what happened last week with the newsletter. Did you read it, Christine? And if you did, what was interesting for you?
Religiously, you know that. Obviously, the number one thing that always stands out for me, and I'm really interested, is OnlyFans. It really picked up momentum during lockdown, huh? Like how people are, creating content, making money, side hustles, main hustles. And it's interesting to think about it in terms of, whether it's taboo or are people actually going to be, is going to go more mainstream throughout the lockdown.
Yeah, very interesting. Hands up, by the way. I'd love to see people. Do you know what OnlyFans is? I mean, no shame if you do or you don't, but I'd be interested to know what the market penetration is for this particular platform. But for the people who don't know, obviously, it's a Google away. But essentially, it is a way in which people can simply create a profile, and you can create private content for subscribers to your account. So instead of following, you subscribe and you pay, and the person will be able to give you whatever they
say. Private content.
Private content. And usually it's basically softcore porn, I think, isn't it? It's like, you know, nudity, a couple of videos, some pictures, stuff like that. And people are making amazing amounts of money doing it. Saying I'm endorsing this, but it's super interesting from my side, because it's like we have to explore ways in which we are diversifying how to make income. That's like something we're all very conscious of right now. And here you see people kind of make YouTuber level type of money, and the question has to be asked. It's like, I need to know more about this platform. Super interesting stuff there. More OnlyFans content going to be in Brain Food on Sunday, by the way, because it's a very interesting day in the life of which this person has actually shared. What she does, how she makes money, and looks like easy street to me. But anyway, so expect a Brain Food OnlyFans soon. No, that's probably in my mind. What else is interesting for you, Christine?
Yeah, I think another one that really stood out as well is, you know, I'm surprised the UK has the most diversity roles. I think you posted something around the head of diversity role being really crucial, which we all know already. But I was surprised that UK has the most diversity roles, which is followed by Australia and the US. I thought US would come first.
Is this the LinkedIn thing?
Yes, it was a LinkedIn. Yeah. So I think the article was around the head of diversity being the most important job at the moment. And remember that particular graph. Yeah, I was shocked. You know, UK was leading, which is great for us.
You know what, I didn't actually pick up that stat. That's really quite interesting. I would have assumed the US, simply because the US seems to be leading the conversation generally with diversity and inclusion and exactly. All those types of things. And I would have assumed that they would have more frequency of these jobs. But I don't know, maybe it's about compliance. I wonder whether there's because the state side, the rules obviously go state to state, and I think there's a lot of there's a lot more freedom for individual entrepreneurs or company owners to make decisions as to how they want to run their business, whereas maybe UK is a little bit more constrained in some places. Yeah. I don't know, but head of diversity, that's obviously an important job in many companies, and probably there's going to be a certain size of company before that actually becomes almost a mandatory type of position to have, I would imagine. Be difficult to get away with not having a job of that type at senior level, if you're beyond a certain number of employees, I would guess.
Yeah. Or also, like, I think during when the first wave of furlough scheme kicked in, you saw a lot of D&I people in that space either being put in furlough or made redundant. Obviously, this was before, you know, the George Floyd incident. So it's interesting to see what happened post that and whether companies are actually putting on the forefront, which increasingly so. I think companies who laid off or put their head of D&I on furlough probably are kicking themselves when that happened.
You know, well, that's a really interesting observation, Christine. I think you're right. It's basically two separate but hugely sort of contradictory type of forces, wasn't there? Mm-hmm. COVID-19 basically just chop everyone who you think is irrelevant, and then you have that terrible incident in the United States, which just sparked the touch paper off. Global sort of protests on general inequity. And suddenly D&I elevates back up to importance. And from the people I speak to, from the vendors who have customers, who speak to their customers and so on, it's like diversifying their employee workforce is the number one priority. It's not like, we can't hire A-list talent or we have a retention problem and all this. It's like, okay, we've now elevated this as the number one thing. So interesting. Yeah, I think if there's any D&I folks that did or unfortunate early cuts, they're probably going to find themselves back in work pretty shortly.
Definitely.
Okay, cool. One more, Christine.
Definitely, I would say probably Darren Murph, the head of remote at GitLab's view on remote work transformation being a full-time job. You know,
right.
I was kind of reflecting on what happened when obviously everything kind of kicked off at the FT, and the reality is it's a cross-functional effort, right? You've got HR looking at culture, employee satisfaction, occupational health. You have the facilities team looking at, you know, how can you actually move the office space into, you know, working from home. Technology, you know, IT support, cloud infrastructure, can we work remotely? And comms, right? It's how do you then communicate whatever decision-making you have as a team? It is a full-time job. I think you can't expect your current teams who are holding those roles to understand everything, right? Like, you're listening to your employees, what do they want? It's a combination of, you know, transformation, strategy, culture, values, bringing all that online. So 100%, like, whether you're a going on a hybrid model, a full-time remote, it's a full-time role.
Yeah, you know what? I was a skeptic when I first saw the title, because I make my judgments based on the title of the article, right? It's like, he must be speaking crap. But then I read it, and then I thought, you know what? He's actually spot on, because he introduced the idea of it not being like a binary switch. And even though we were forced to do, you know, everyone like from the office to remote, and it was a black and white scenario. But if you want to think about transitioning this permanently, you start having to cater for different employee needs, and they're going to be different. Some of them are going to want remote only. Some of them are going to want choices. Some of them are going to back to office. And to handle all of that process, it's a transition, and it's a change management job, and it is a full-time role. So head of remote in the transitionary phase, I think, yeah, that's going to be a job for about 12, 18 months at least going forward, where there's going to be people who are going to basically be reconfiguring your company. You know, what does it look like? You know, who actually does need to be in physical proximity? Who can go remotely? Who should go remotely? I mean, maybe now CEOs are now recognizing probably productivity sort of spiking and dipping based on who is remote and who isn't. And you may suddenly have data to say, you know what, these guys shouldn't be in the same in the office together, because they actually disrupt each other. They should be totally separate. So I think we're going to start having those considerations. And then we're going to I think this job is going to be up there. Definitely something I don't think, you know, you can't part-time it. And right now, I would imagine most people who have the responsibilities probably going to be a head of HR or something like that, and they're probably struggling, I would imagine, and these would be fully on this.
Yeah, it's also confusing because the policies are changing all the time. So, you know, you gotta look at government guidance, and then from there, really then kind of reverse engineer it and listening to your people at the same time. So it's quite a complicated role.
You're still looking at government guidance, Christine?
Well, I try to, but, you know, it changes every week. So
I gave up on that in May. It was like, what is the point? They have no idea what they're doing. It's like, what you got to do is just take the optimal risk, lower the risk as much as you can. You know, I mean, you can't. Right now, for the folks who are not in the UK, by the way, we just get contradictory signals as a guarantee from the government every day. It's like, yeah, everyone back to the office, but no more than six people in one place. It's like, what are you going to do?
But you go to the pub together.
Exactly. Have you seen an underground station? I mean, have you been in the tube? Ridiculous. Moving on. Let's talk about the topic to hand, because it's actually totally related to this. Debiasing the candidate interview. I think one of the things that's really interesting about this topic is we were looking at the tactics to do this here, because it's not about whether it is a good or bad idea. It is how do we do it? And I just wonder whether you have any theories on this yourself, Christine, as a recruiter. You know, I'm not looking at you as an expert in any way in this or have any special knowledge, but as a person that has recruited people, what are your thoughts on how do you debias this situation to give people more of a fair shot at getting through?
Yeah, it's a good question. We definitely think about it a lot as a team, because predominantly I work with the engineers and designers. We have certain teams which are probably more aware of the biases more than others. And I think really in order to do that, you really have to just standardize your interview process as much as possible. And by that, I mean, you know, we always push our teams to use job scorecards, right? So once you've established what your core competencies are, I get all the interviewing teams to go in with a particular job scorecard related related to that particular role and say, by the time you come out of the interview, we are all going to be looking at the numbers that you're scoring the candidates on. So that way, you know, they're not prone to having a wash up or a debriefing session together and being influenced by each other's decision making, which I've seen happen in the past. That was like a really kind of quicker fix for me, really.
So quick stop there. Basically, the scorecards need to be scored independently and not after discussion. I think that's a really important point, isn't it?
Definitely, because we've seen it in the past. It just happens. There's so much bias. The reality is bias happens at every stage in the process. So especially if they don't know what they're going in and interviewing, they're going to come out, talk about it, and then decide this is their preferred candidate because of X, Y, Z. So that doesn't quite make any sense for me. And I know there's a lot of talk as well about anonymizing CVs and taking out education. So we do that with one particular team. And the interesting thing is we've got two teams who hire for exactly the same skill sets, right? So we thought we'd do an experiment where one team we'd anonymize the CVs and one team we didn't. And actually the team that didn't ended up having more diverse candidates in the interview process than the ones who actually anonymized it. So I don't know what the answer is there just yet. I'll let you know when I know, but it makes me question.
Really interesting phenomenon. And actually, I think I will bring Markelos on later on. He's the CEO of Brick, who is going with a blind screening type of process and challenging that to see, okay, does it actually produce the output? And I think the reason why is because the bias then goes off the name and maybe goes to the educational institution, let's say, or even geography, location, some other signals in the CV, which tells you, oh, this is a better candidate or not a better candidate. And it's all subliminal stuff. And you end up sort of passing those people further forward. So maybe it just needs to be even more deeply anonymized. The BBC, actually, I think I'm okay to say this, they also had this problem when they went with an anonymization approach for their tech team, and they ended up producing, you know, more white men, basically, as a result of this. And that wasn't what they were ideally looking to do. And they questioned, okay, why was that? Yeah. And I think that was their conclusions. It was essentially they were looking instead at university degrees, looking at sort of comp sci degrees, et cetera, and that, you know, is seeded very heavily with certain demographics. So it means that, you know, you're already narrowing your pipeline without necessarily being conscious of it, which is what we're talking about, subconscious bias. One more technique or thing before we bring Lorne on, who's going to tell us all about it. What's your thoughts, Christine?
Oh, I'm sorry. Say that again. Technical.
Yeah, one more sort of technique or angle on biasing.
So in my previous role, we used HackerRank. So after I speak to the candidate, I'll say, right, you know, we've got a short technical task. So it'd be great for you to complete it before, you know, you come on site and meet with the teams. That was obviously a little bit challenging. And I think someone on your LinkedIn mentioned this as well, is if you don't have a big brand behind you, to get someone to do a 1 hour technical task is a bit tricky. That's why having that initial touch point for me to say, hey, love speaking to you, you know, it's going to really quick, short technical test. But I find that helps because, again, they're not looking at the CVs. By then, we're already predetermining that they have to have a certain level of, you know, let's say Swift skills because they're an iOS engineer. And then once they pass the test, they can go on and interview with the teams. So there's no CVs involved. It's just purely based on the technical skills itself.
Yeah. So establishing competence really before the biography even happens is critically important. But then, of course, you've got that, I'm tempted to say the UX of it, it's like difficult for a candidate or just a person. You might have just headhunted them, so they're not even thinking like a candidate.
Yeah.
And the first thing you can do is throw them a technical test. They're going to say, come on, you're coming at me. You got to pitch me. And then, of course, that means you've got to get involved and see them and do all this stuff. So really interesting challenge. But this is why we're all thinking about it and putting energy that way. So that's fantastic stuff. Okay, let's bring Lorne on. He is... in fact, Lorne can introduce himself. Let's see if we can, first of all, execute this part, which is to get him on screen, and we'll be able to see his angle on it. I think I'm super interested to see it. Oh, there he is, Lorne Epstein. How are you doing, sir?
Great. Thanks so much for having me on. What an amazing show, and you've got all these fantastic people commenting on unconscious bias. I like what Christine said earlier. I thought both the points were spot on.
Great. Well, listen, Lon, they've all come to see you because you're a very famous man in the industry. But actually, for the people who don't know you, Lon, I wonder whether you could just quickly introduce yourself to the audience, like what it is you do and who you are, essentially.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Lon Epstein, and I've started recruiting in 1996 in New York City. And I moved in through leadership roles in recruiting. And about 4 years ago, I got a radio show here in Arlington, Virginia, and the show is about the workplace. And in about 6 years ago, I developed an unconscious bias workshop. And in a very strange turn of events, you were saying, Christine, about how people are pivoting with the new economy. Earlier this year, my college professor suggested that I take my experiential workshop in unconscious bias and submit it to an experiential conference, which it got accepted and I was going to give it. But then I got into graduate school, and the graduate school class was on the same day as the conference. And my teacher said, you can't go to the conference, you got to come to class. So she said, but you can give the workshop to the students because it's an organizational development program and they'd be really interested in it. So the school sponsored the first event, which was in April. And because of COVID, we had to do it online. And not thinking I was going to go do this as a thing, but we had 140 people on the first workshop, and then 140 people on the next one, and 140 people. And so it's now a thing. I'm now giving my workshops on unconscious bias pretty much all the time. That's what I'm doing.
That's fantastic. And great to get a little bit of insight as to what you've learned in your journey as a recruiter, as a broadcaster, and also as a trainer now, as an educator on this topic. Tell us a little bit about the nature of unconscious bias, particularly about, you know, a lot of people have a negative view of it. You know, they assume that there's a moral flaw if you walk in with a bias. But I had that accusation with that LinkedIn post. I think people saying, yeah, any bias is bad. And I was saying, you know, I'm not trying to endorse someone who's like a rabid racist. All I'm saying is that we probably are quite biased in most of the time. There's a utility behind these types of cognitive shortcuts, because if we didn't have those shortcuts and didn't develop them, we would struggle to navigate the day. Most of the time, we're not thinking that hard about most of the things we're doing. And a lot of the sort of ways in which we do it is because we've done it before and it worked, no one died, therefore I'm going to try it, I'm going to do it again. And this is how bias and prejudice builds up over time if you get it wrong, or, you know, you've learned the wrong lessons. So I just wanted to hear your perspective on this, the moral aspect of bias. What are your views on that, Lon?
That's a great point. So everyone has unconscious bias. Unconscious bias is a function of the brain, specifically the amygdala and the basal ganglia and a few other pieces, but really the amygdala. And the reason we have it is that it's part of our reptilian brain, our original brain from hundreds of thousands of years ago. If the three of us were by a little lake in the woods and we saw another tribe of folks across the lake, we'd either run or we'd attack them. We would not have a conversation to see if we would get along. That was how we survived. And so that is part of our inherent brain. We can't, you know, you can mitigate it, but it's, if you're alive, and I don't know what happens after you're not alive, you have unconscious bias. And it is about mitigating a lot of the decision points, not just to keep us safe, but it's also an energy conservation. So our brain is designed to conserve energy. And all those parts of our brain that make those decisions are doing that. Now, it was great then, and now it's not so great. And sometimes it is, right? If you're driving along the road and all of a sudden you make a quick turn to the right or the left, it's because your unconscious bias is taking care of it. Your amygdala is triggered. Your amygdala is constantly scanning for threats, and you do an action.
Yep.
Unfortunately, if you get bitten by a dog two or three times, now you're afraid of dogs, right? And that may not be the right kind of bias. And so there are ways. I'm going to quickly, because I don't know how much time exactly we have, but I wanted to plug two books that are not mine that I think are really awesome. So one is like my Bible, which is Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. This is a great book on understanding how the brain works. There's a lot of science behind it. Because of fMRI, because of new kinds of imaging, we can see the brain when it's doing certain things, and they can watch the blood flow. Now, it's not always 100% accurate, but it's really good data. And the other one my buddy here, Howard Ross, Everyday Bias. This is awesome, right? I mean, these are great tools, and not just this, but there's plenty of information out there to explain what bias is. Now, how do we mitigate it, right? Now we know it's there. It's part of our brain. We all experience it. Christine, what you said about scorecard interviewings, 100%. Scorecard interviewings are great, and I do workshops on that, and have some open time to just talk, right? Don't have someone there just be like scoring someone, but also have a time.
All right, that's a really important point. So you've introduced the idea of having, like, not over-optimizing for the time at interview. So I think that's one of the things that I've seen happen really badly, where someone is just literally so over-optimized, they're rude. It's like, okay, I've got what I need, see you. I'm shocked. So I was sitting in as a recruiter. I was shocked at observing that experience. I thought, this dude's prepared for an interview. You've come in and you've literally almost extracted energy, and then you've gone. And it's like, no, man, this is not how it works. So firstly, that's I think that's unethical and unprofessional. But the other side, you're saying there's a practical reason not to do that, because you need to create some open space for what? What do you hope to happen where there's no scheduling, or where there isn't a sort of a fixed agenda for that chat?
Relationship, right? We got to connect with each other. You gotta give. I mean, that should, the beginning of an interview should be about relationship. I mean, I don't want to give a particular structure, but you should walk away with having a relationship with the candidate. You want them to be as comfortable as possible. Look, we got 300 recruiters. Everyone knows if a candidate is relaxed and saying everything they need to say, you get the best outcomes. So scorecard's great, right? And give time for that. And also, I recommend things like experiential interviewing, where you have people do the thing that they're supposed to do in their job, and you observe it, right? I mean, football players, basketball players, they all get hired that way. And even then, it's not always right. So that's, I think, you know, overarching, one of the overarching things about hiring is that we got to understand, our leaders have to understand, that you're never going to get it 100% right. So then you get to data. Track your data. What are the things you want to track, and see how you can make it better, right? My come from is just make it better, right? You're never going to mitigate all of bias. It's always going to be there.
Two really important points I just want to raise here, because so much good stuff. The first one is you got to get the assessment as close to the job as possible. So I used to call this real world assessment, which is essentially whatever you're paying this person to do, when you're interviewing or assessing this person, you've got to get close to that. So for instance, you're hiring a marketing person, you expect this person, I don't know, to create some employer branding copy or something of that type, have them do that. It's actually a better kind of measure of their competence than it is sitting face to face to them and having a chat. Or having an interview. The interview is just a proxy for the job. So you've got to get closer to the job. And the second thing you mentioned was almost an acceptance that perfection is not achievable, and it's actually a problem if you think it is.
Totally.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So about 6 years ago, I was leading a TA team for a global software company. And like in my first week, I was told to hire a team of recruiters in India, in several cities. I'd never been to India. I never hired recruiters in India. So what I did was, for a month, I did phone screens with about 140 recruiters on Skype. And I had my down select of about 14. And then on the next month, I flew to India and I had all the recruiters come to one of the offices for a day. And I had them walk into a room where me and the other vice presidents were just observing. And the first thing I did was I had them get in pairs and just talk. They talked for like 5 minutes, no structure. After they talked, I had them stand up one at a time and tell everyone what they heard. Now, as a recruiter, you're both recruiters, what was I testing for?
Listening skills.
And?
Don't put me on the spot, man.
Communicating, right? What do recruiters do? They listen and they talk, right? Fundamental, they listen and they talk. Then I had them do job descriptions. They broke up into different groups and they wrote job descriptions with the managers there. Again, then we sent them into offices and they recruited. We had them the one in the monster in India, and they
Naukri.
And And then we just scored them. We went around, I had scorecards and we were scoring them, and then we had lunch. And so there was a mixture of scoring and experiential interviewing. And the recruiters loved it. They loved it because they were like, this is what I want to show you. I don't want to talk about what I do. I want to show you what I do. And good recruiters want to show you how good they are. So it was great. And the team was fantastic that we hired. Anyway, that's just an example.
Yeah, it's a great example. I tell you another thing that's kind of introduced is the idea of how the experience can be visualized. Because what you've presented with this kind of, mass interviewing, if you like, is that it actually flattens it in the sense that the relationships people are building are very peer-to-peer. There's less of this hierarchical feeling that is always the case when you're the one person going through an interview process. You know, it's like I see it very much like the chevrons I'm a Battlestar Galactica fan. I don't know whether you guys are, but you remember when the starfighters came out of the chute? It was like a tunnel. And it's so intimidating. If you're a candidate, you're going through that experience, and like at every chevron, there's going to be another thing that is going to cause you to trip up. Or another thing that you've got to, literally another hoop you've got to jump over. And all of that, I think, doesn't contribute to great performance, or at least prejudices your performance. If you're a good, high-pressure person, you know, you can deal with it, then great, you can scoot through. But if you're a person that doesn't have that particular skill set, which, by the way, might be irrelevant for the job that you're actually recruiting for, you might flunk some of that, in which case... you're failing to the company that is failing to do the hiring of the top talent there.
It's spot on. It's exactly right.
Cool. Let's have a look at some of the deeper stuff in terms of the workshop stuff, Lorne. When people have gone through this experience with you, what are they reporting that they've learned? Like, what have they come in? What have they come away out of this for? Yeah. Because I'd be interested to know what the gaps were. You know, what their own self perception of these gaps might have been.
That's a great question. So, thank you. I've been collecting data. So, when people do the workshop, before the workshop, they do a survey, and after the workshop, they do a survey. And one of our workshops, we had a 30% increase in people's ability to deal with unconscious bias. So that's a significant bump, right? So there is a measure. And second book, Everyday Bias by Howard Ross. So, and then people are saying, here's how I'm gonna use it. So just yesterday I worked with a client, a specific client, a global telecom client, and I had them come up with solutions because all of my workshops are experiential, right? I don't tell you have bias. You do exercises where you see what's going on in there. And there was a process that they had where they would have meetings where they would call people from around the continent to come to an office for a meeting. But since people only saw each other like once every 6 months or so, people would come in at different times and then they would talk and get to know each other. And the meeting would invariably start late. And they didn't really see that there was a bias here, right? There was a bias in how people were perceiving the relationships. Anyway, afterwards, they redid the process. Simple thing, small little process. And so those are the kinds of things that I see as outcomes. They to change, make small changes, right? Because sometimes the big changes are hard and you want to show efficacy, right? Of like, hey, we just did this one thing. And now instead of wasting 20 people's 15 minutes every other week or every 6 months, you're now capturing that revenue back, you're capturing that time back, you're being more productive. People are just happier about what it is. And what it comes down to in my experience is that you've got to talk about it, right? So there's got to be a safe space. And by safe space, we had all acknowledged that we're all biased, right? And it's okay to talk about it. And we have to have languaging for it. So languaging is really important that we can talk about it in ways that make people safe, right? And then we got to figure out how we're going to measure our movements, right? So that if you're doing something and you say, okay, we're going to do something differently, measure what that is. And it may take a while to get a result. It may not. Sorry, I'm just kind of going on a tangent.
No, tonight. This is great. And what I actually, at any moment, I wanted to stop you, Lon, but you just kind of coming out with such great stuff. I wanted to keep the flow. But one thing you mentioned there was creating the safe space, and that's a really important topic. I want to cover, because I think a lot of people have misconceptions as to what that is. Some people are very dismissive of the entire idea of it, even when I think they may actually benefit hugely from this. So can you kind of describe, in fact, Christine also, I mean, what's your view of what a safe space is to have a discussion of this type? I mean, how would you define it? And after how do you define it? How do you create it? Christine, go to you first.
Yeah, I've been talking for a while. They're bored. They're tired of listening to me.
Christine, you're on mute, I think. Go. Christine, you're on mute. Does she know she's on mute?
Christine asked, is it typically mandated or voluntary? And it's usually voluntary. I don't
get it. Why are you asking that? Christina, can you not speak?
You can't unmute? You can't unmute her.
Oh, shit. Have I unmuted her? Sorry. I don't have this power. Say something, Christine.
In Zoomology.
I don't know how I did that. I'm pretty certain I didn't do this, Christine.
Kathy. That's funny, you're sure.
All right. Whilst I'm sure, I try to finish that, Lon, can I go to you and ask you the same question while I figure out how to fix this with Christine?
Yeah. So, you know, I get that because these words, these phrases get into the culture, they get adulterated. So they're words that mean something to one person different than another person. So I want to talk about what a safe space is, because it's just like, if you're talking to a good friend and you can say whatever you need to say, that's a safe space, right? Without any judgment, like you're not going to be judged or there's no negative consequence. One of the things I do in my workshop, because we do sharing, particularly in public settings, when people stand up to share, and it's always voluntary, I ask the audience to not laugh, to not comment, and to just listen. And it's a very different experience when people feel like there's a space for them to just talk and not to hear anything come back. As a married guy, and there may be some married people out there, I have learned that my wife just wants me to listen sometimes and just shut the F up and not say anything. And I think that's what it is to create a safe space, that we're okay. Go ahead.
That's a really important point. This is like really important, like relationship management stuff, which I've come to realize that is what an interview is. It's like an acceleration of a relationship, isn't it? And we're trying as a business, we're trying to do it efficiently. But what we're really trying to do is to get to a point where we're friends with this person so that we know each other and have a trust level to the point that we can operate successfully together. The first part is you've got to basically practice this active listening, whereby, you know what, Lon, you're going to say your piece. I'm not going to interrupt you. So please, you need to signal to me that you're finished and then I'll say something. So I've got to practice literally not interrupting, even though I feel like I should.
Totally. Yeah. It's really interesting. Generous listening. And you're back, Christine. Why don't you?
Hey, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yay. It's one of the situations like I want to unmute, but I can't unmute.
Switch on. I just want to say to everyone, I was not responsible for that. I would never mute Christine.
Sure.
Why would I ever do that?
We love you anyway, hon. We love you anyway.
So sorry I missed the last few minutes. But I definitely had a question earlier, which I think is interesting because we do run a lot of unconscious bias training in the office. But I find always the people who come, so it's on a voluntary basis. People who come are always the ones who are more active or they're more aware of their biases. Whereas the ones who we need to come, they don't tend to sign up. So how do you get around that? Like, do you mandate it? Like what do you see is the successful strategies that, you know, you've implemented?
Okay. So the hardest thing in all of human engagement is to change the way you perceive something. Right. I mean, it's just the most difficult thing. And to change the way someone else perceives something is more difficult. So I don't have an answer on how do you get people who may appear to be suffering from bias more than others to get on, to come to a training. But if you create these things that we've talked about, scorecards, experiential interviewing, and all these things, that will mitigate bias. And you can, if you show them the results, they may, it may open them up. It may not. I'll give you an example. So there was a study done of the NBA, the National Basketball Association, mm-hmm. where, and this was several years ago. So they were looking for bias in how African-American referees call fouls on African-American players and white players, and also how white referees call fouls on African-American players and white players. Well, there was a huge amount of bias. So white refs were calling more fouls on black players, and mm-hmm. it was a little bit less, but the same for African-American refs. So they looked at like thousands and thousands of videos. So statistically, it was spot on. And they shared the report. And the NBA was like, oh my God, you know. And 3 years later, they did the exact same study and the bias was gone. It was gone. And why it was gone is that they just talked about it. And the players and the refs just became aware, like, oh, they don't want to, you know, they don't, refs are probably want to be good refs, right? Like teachers want to be good teachers. People want to be good people. There is an inherent motivation for us to be better. And so that's what drove the shift. And that I think can happen with a lot of things. There are 170 different classifications, more than 170 of bias. And not all bias is what we're talking about, right? We're talking about unconscious bias where you didn't know that you didn't know that you had a bias. When Torin Ellis was on my radio show with another woman on a country, they were talking to me about 4 years ago, and they said, diversity is not about just gender, color. It was about diversity of thought. And I had never thought that. Mm. I never thought like, oh, diversity of thought is like a diversity. And it was just blew me away, right? So some of us who are explorers who want to learn, right? And I think, you know, we want to get better, can be affected by that. But not everyone's going to be, right? Not everyone's going to like want to.
You know, on this point, just to go back to it, really important one you raised, Christine, like how do we actually get everyone in the room that needs to be there? Because if you make it voluntary, you're absolutely right. It attracts the people that are motivated already. Mm. I remember doing something at a conference where I was moderating a panel and it was about diversity or whatnot. Guess who was in the audience? It was all women. It was all minorities. I'm thinking, I actually said it out in the crowd. I said, look, the main thing we have here, actually, we have a lack of diversity in the audience.
Yeah.
The demographic that's turned up to talk about this is missing a huge component, which is white males. And that's not just laying it on for white males sort of having this additional responsibility. But I just wondered whether we are creating a safe space for white males to step in, because do they feel as if they're entering a space that they don't belong or their voice isn't respected or they won't be listened to? In your term, Lorne, when you mentioned that, can a person step up and say something where their identity isn't the foremost thing that determines the value of this contribution? And, you know, I think we've got a long way to go. Now, what I do think is true is that the mandated policy can also have a pushback, because isn't that there's a bunch of research to say that if you force people to do training, people get really upset by it and think, This is a pile of crap. So maybe the kind of the tooling bit, maybe the way to do it, you drop it in as a tool. You give people practical tools to do their job better, and then suddenly they'll come to the realization themselves without having necessarily this top down drum beating approach, which may be counterproductive. I don't know. People in the crowd, if you've got an idea how to do this, I'd love to hear your comments on it. Because if you've also kind of held a workshop internally, or you've done something on diversity, or you've done whatever, and guess what? You found the people registering are exactly, you know, the people who are already in the choir. What do you do about that? What has been your technique? I'd love to hear about that. Oh, by the way, finally, a few people have asked some questions in the chat stream. We're going to miss those if you put them in there. So can I ask you to ask the question in the ask a question section at the bottom of the screen? I know it's a bit of a pain in the ass, but we're going to go to that in the final part of this show so that we'll be able to explore that in a bit more depth. So ask a question feature at the bottom of the screen will be where we're going to deal with that. Okay.
Well, let's, Taylor asked, I see a question Taylor asked. Can I answer that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so Taylor asked, can we talk about how to show, measure those results? Yes, we can. So we all know turnover, retention, employee satisfaction, those are really good measures of what's going on in an organization. You can measure that and then put in some new tools to mitigate bias and see how that goes. There's also the IAT. The IAT is the implicit, But the IAT is a tool that measures bias, and you can have people take it and see how, and they would see how they do. You wouldn't see it, but they would see how they do. Do some workshops, do some training, have people read books, kind of just make it part of the zeitgeist, and then have them take it again. So yeah, I mean, you want to, you know, you want to have measurements that are agreed upon, but based on results, particularly in hiring, right? Like, how are you hiring? Are you hiring a more diverse group of people? And that can mean a lot of things, right? Now there's multiple dimensions. It's not just the pigments, the amount of pigment they have in their skin, or the gender that they identify as. It's a lot of things. And there's lots of great research to tell your managers. McKinsey, Why Diversity Matters, Harvard Business Review, tons of studies now that are, it's 100%. The more diverse an organization is, the more profitable they are, the more resilient they are. So there's business reasons, other than I think it's moral and ethically right. But
yeah, I think one thing we've seen here is that I think the business argument has been fairly strong for a number of years, but these days I think it's now elevated even further now to becoming kind of an ethical challenge also, and an ethical kind of mission, which I think I'm happy to embrace. By the way, I'm just going to share a link there to the Brain Food Larder. The reason for that is if you just search for D&I in that sort of category, there'll be hundreds of articles. A lot of the research that Lon mentioned there could be found in that link, so please go and check it out. I want to move this on to technology because this week's sponsor are a company called Brick, which are a business that is in the business of trying to de-bias the interview process. And I want to bring Markelos on, the CEO of the company, to get his vision to figure out exactly how technology can play a role. But before I do that, I wanted to throw it back to you two to say, what do you think of tech as a tool to help us do this? I mean, where do you place the value of it? Where do you think it should really fit in that recruiting funnel? Christine, let's go to you first on that.
I mean, gotta love it and hate it at the same time, because we were talking about this actually last week at our virtual offsite. I think tech has to enable it, but it can't really be the barrier, because what we're finding is it's just more and more tech fatigue. It's like, oh no, there's another platform, there's another system. So what can we do to help us automate it as much as possible? And I say that because recruiting is purely, it's a human touch, it's a personal experience. A lot of it is, you know, picking up the phone, speaking to the candidate. So it's good to have, let's say, the likes of like HackerRank or, you know, something that can automate the interview process scheduling. But ultimately, I still think there is an importance in that human connection. So I believe in the tech to help facilitate the process and making it easier, but I don't think tech should fully take over the process. So, you know, you hear things like using tech to sift through high volume roles. I've heard some horror stories about that. So I still feel quite passionate about the fact that this is still be a human at the other end and screening CVs and speaking to candidates. But
that's my view. Really interesting. Thank you, Christine. How about you, Lon? Where do you see technology playing a role in de-biasing the assessment process?
Well, at first, I think Christine's spot on. I mean, I think we get very fatigued by technology. And I think that the good, in my experience, the good technology is in my workflow. Like, I'm doing my job and the technology is just kind of like there, you know, capturing things and doing stuff that I don't have to necessarily interact with, because that's, again, more time. I did take a look at the stuff that Brick has, and we spoke earlier this week, and I think it's really good. I think it's got like real legs. I know they got a bunch of customers, and they'll talk about it. You know, I'm not paid, but I'm just plugging, like, tools like Smart Recruiters that use scorecards is great, right? Scorecards can be automated. That's great technology, things like that, you know. And everyone interviews differently, right? Every company has a different need and a different kind of demographic that they're recruiting for, or not demographic, but skill set. And so you have to really kind of look and see what works, right? There's, like you said, there's too much technology. You got to find the right thing that works and not feel like, you know, oh, I don't have the right tech because I'm not getting my thing. So what's the tech that's going to solve my problem? You could solve a lot of these problems without tech, right? You can solve a lot of them by just training people, having people practice, you know, have your CEO apply for a job and go through your interview process.
Yeah. You know what? I think it's just this conversation has kind of caused me to think maybe if tech fatigue is definitely a thing, and I'm a big tech fan, obviously, you know, I think tooling really does help. And I think tooling can actually help change culture also. You know, so it's not just, you know, a culture only solution in my view. But I just wonder whether if a recruiter, operating recruiter, is overloaded already, you know, with responsibilities, and then there's more, there's already managing five tools, there's another five tools that they need to look at and whatever, they're actually going to be biased against those tools. I mean, their selection or opinion against their tools is probably towards the negative, because they're thinking, I actually can't handle learning another thing. So I'm not going to do that. However good it is, I don't want to learn it. I'm out. So I just wonder whether there may be a role for a person who is like a tools master in a TA function, where the guy or the girl is the person that basically looks at these different tools in different places, more or less uses them, but in the end just pipes over the qualified candidates or the screen candidates to the recruiter, who, in your view, Christine, you know, is going to do the call, the relationship management. We talked about that before as well with you, Lorne. They can do that part. To all intents and purposes, they don't see the tool. Like, they're not involved in the tool usage. There is a tool user that does that in front, at the top end of the funnel, maybe. I don't know. Speculating widely. Yeah.
I fear that person may end up being the go-to person. I do see it sometimes where hiring managers are like, I don't know how to create a job requisition on Workday. Can you do it for me? I'm like, oh my God. So I end up being that default go-to person to create everything, because they don't want to learn how to use the tool. So yeah, it's definitely, it'll be interesting to see, rather than being reactive, is can we actually help facilitate and push back some of that responsibility back to the hiring managers?
Yeah, this is it. Like, do you disperse tool usage more widely so that everyone is using the tool and therefore everyone gets good at it and fluent with it, in the same way we all know how to use email, for instance? You know, you don't have to, there's not an email user in the
business. Yeah.
Or do we pull it, centralize it, and even more centralize it, so there is one person using email and everyone else, you know what I mean? This is the master controller.
Anyway,
let me see if I can get Markelos on, because I want to hear a little bit more about his product, particularly this combo of skills plus personality assessment. Which I think has some promise, particularly when you're dealing with applicant flow. I do think that kicking bias down the road is an incremental good. You know, when people say, yeah, but at some point you're going to be having a human being interviewing this person and they're going to be biased, my response to that is, yes, that may be the case, but you know what? That's still better happening at the lower down the funnel than it is right at the beginning, because at the beginning, it's going to be a disaster. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there he is. Markelos, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, and it's such an honor to be in such a distinguished panel. I feel important already.
It's great to have you on, man. Listen, Markelos, I just wanted to, firstly, can you quickly introduce yourself and the business? It'd be good to get a strap line from you, actually, as to what Brick does, because I might have mangled it earlier.
Oh, yeah, an opportunity to plug ourselves. Awesome. So I'm the CEO of Brick, and we've created Brick essentially around the inefficiencies that we saw in hiring. And we saw all these challenges by people, and we found these solutions, and we said, there must be a better way. And we looked at all the different tools, and we realized that it takes hours to get, you know, the things together, and we'd have to train people, and people would get a 20-page report, and they need a three-week training before they can even read it. So we said, okay, excellence doesn't require perfection. What kind of tooling can we give to recruiters and hiring managers to help them be top of funnel, look at all the incoming talent, sift it with objective criteria? And this was the blind screening process is so important for us, because that's the only way we can remove all that bias. Everything that we discussed so far is awesome. But A, if I get 5 white males in my shortlist, I can remove all the bias I want. I'm still going to be interviewing 5 white males. So how can we make sure that the representation of the talent is the same from the whole funnel to the top of the funnel to the people who make it in the shortlist? How can we do this in a way that integrates with the ATSs, where people don't have to spend weeks in training? most of our customers can deploy our solution within a single day. Okay, this takes, you know, some work in it, but it's a single day. Next day, they start screening candidates using our solution. And we can't replace people. This is a fallacy. If you think that you're going to have a system that's going to solve all your recruiting problems, you're never going to find it. But what we can do is we can support recruiters and, very important, support hiring managers by giving them a layer of objective data. You never make your decision based on one data point, 20 data points, however many we provide, right? But you should look at this and look at the candidate and look at all the other things and then make a call. But it's so easier to look at candidates when you say, okay, here's the same base of data for everyone. Here's what I know about this. Here are the areas of concern for each person. And it just makes it so easier for everyone to make better decisions. Perfect? I'm going to say not yet.
That's very generous of you to say, Makelos. You know what's interesting about this is that when you think about what the purpose of an interview is, it is actually to get that data, isn't it? So in many respects, if you can capture a lot of that information at a pre-interview stage, it might actually make the overall process much more efficient. It's just that you've got to invest a little bit of thought. We're talking about unconscious bias right at the beginning with Lorne there. One of the biases we've got to deal with is, oh my God, too many tools. That in itself is, you know, this aversion of taking more tooling is one of the first things that we've got to deal with. There may be some ways in which these tools could potentially be useful. The debiasing process is at the top of the funnel, as you mentioned, Makelos. So are you saying that essentially this is an anonymizer? It's a way to anonymize the applicant?
No, it is essentially, but it's not just that. See, everybody's still, 95%, still screening people based on their resumes. Resumes are, most of you, well, most of this panel at least knows, is a 500-year-old technology. They have been around since the 1500s. So, you know, this is the year 2020, and it sounds odd to be relying on something that has been done for the past 500 years. Can we not do better? And the problem with resumes is that there's so much, there are so many articles about it and research that says that it's not representative. You have the wrong set of data for the candidate, and it's not even right. Even if you had exactly the right points, you can't guarantee that it's accurate. So any decision you make on the resumes, even if you manage to completely debias resume screening, which I don't think you can, but even if you were to manage that, it's still not going to be a right decision. Now, again, there is no perfect solution to the problem. But what we're trying to say is that we look at all the theories, and we looked at a bunch of great research that has been done on what's the best predictor of future job performance. It's definitely not resumes. It's not job experience. The correlation between job experience and how people actually do in a role is very, very low. And, you know, there are different things that you can do. It's interviews, it's EQ tests, it's IQ tests, blah, blah, blah. Turns out that the best by far, but still imperfect measure, is a combination of seeing what this person wants to do, so their personality, and what this person can do, their skills. And I want to take a moment here and say that when I say skills, these are not hard skills. So this is not the kind of thing that HackerRank does. You need to see if this person can do the, you know, the basic skills, numbers, logical, verbal, attention to detail, and if he likes to do this sort of work. This gives us the best proxy for future job performance. Imperfect, but when you have to deal with 500 candidates, or 1,000, and you know, we have customers who we routinely see running 5,000 candidates through a single position. How are you supposed to figure it out? This gives an objective process where all people go through the same sieve and you can move on by matching not only what the job requires, but sometimes it's a company thing, right? And I give this very simple example, an accountant. An accountant that's going to work for us, for Brick, has definitely a different cultural aspect into his role than someone who's going to work for, say, PricewaterhouseCoopers. Mm. Accountants, their role description is the same. Mm-hmm. Two completely different people are going to be happy in each company. If you keep forgetting that aspect, that you're hiring a person for a role and for a company, you're never going to be finding the right candidates.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, Makelos. It's the concept of what a job is. It's not a job is not a discrete unit isolated from the context of that job. As you say, it may have the same job title, but a different meaning in a different culture, in a different company, a different function even. I mean, Christine, you and I kind of probably closer to the as operating recruiters, we've had experience of this where, you know, oh, we're looking for a recruiter and the job is exactly the copy paste job description, you know, from whatever. And you apply for it and you find out, oh, this is like really all about sourcing, or you go to a different business and it's not, it's all about like stakeholder management because you're spending all your time, you know, organizing process internally, totally different skills, but they may be described in the same way. And we're not getting basically beyond, I tell you what, it's a mirror version of the job, of the CV, isn't it? Where the CV might be bad data, but the job description is bad data also. So you got two sets of bad data and we're trying to, you know, somehow make sure that's going to result in a good match, not happening. Super interesting. Okay, listen, we're running really short on time. So I want to just quickly dive into some of these questions. I think some of them are really interesting. Let's go answer some of these. First one here is from Anthea. She's saying, beyond merely participating in conversations internally, how can employees outside of HR help with reducing bias before or during the recruiting process? That's a super interesting question. So any thoughts on that? Christine, you want to just give a bit of a response to this one?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I think we definitely see it a lot at the FT. We have a lot of very engaged, probably the people who go to the same training, who start having those conversations. And I think having the evangelists or having the advocates internally really does help, because they will actually come up to me and say, hey, Christine, I read this article. Have we tried implementing XYZ? Right. So in a way, it helps open that dialogue and then they can then influence people within their immediate teams. So it's interesting, I think, identifying who your evangelists are in those particular areas would be an interesting first step. Hopefully that answers your question.
Really interesting. Yeah. How about you, Lauren? You got any thoughts on this one?
Yeah. So one, obviously, take my workshops. But don't what? I'm going to put my link in before I finish. So I think what everyone's been saying is spot on. That there needs to be a message, a cultural shift coming from wherever the cultural shifts come from. So if it's the CEO or the CMO, start talking about these things, is we're going to have conversations about this. And it's going to become part of our dialogue about diversity dimensions and what does it mean and what does gender fluid mean and what do all these words mean. But also, like, hearing stories, I bet if I asked everyone here and on there, have you ever experienced being biased against? Mm-hmm. Like, have you all been experienced? Have you ever been experienced the victim of bias? I'm asking.
Yeah, everyone's going to say yes to that. Yeah,
definitely.
Wait, how's it feel?
Look, I'm always looking at this from a very narrow funnel, if you like, because of our tech and what our customers are doing. But what they've reported to us that has been really interesting is when they set up their job profiles, and their job profiles are no longer, I'm looking at an accountant, but it's like, here are the personality traits, here's what we expect in terms of cognitive, and they sit down with the hiring manager. Because then, you know, the hiring manager comes in and says, I want this and this and that. And when they realize how some of the things that they're asking actually can't coexist, so I want someone who's a rule follower but then breaks out of the box, you can have both. So this puts a lot of great questions, and that's the power of objective data, right? Once you set a profile and you say, between this and that, this is more important. And this is what the theory says. So for this kind of role, if I need a data engineer, I can't have a data engineer who's going to be warm and fuzzy. Most of the time, data engineers are going to be people who are very self-reliant. They like to be left alone. So I'm going to have to go for that. And they make all these choices. And that takes a lot of discussion. It helps people realize that what they had in their mind is sometimes unrealistic. And then you have this objective set of data where you say, yeah, okay, I was looking for that, but now I understand it. And this one is actually a great fit.
You know what? That's a really interesting point also, Marcelos, when you're talking about the trade-offs that are required when you're constructing a job or any requisition, right? If I want something, typically there is a trade-off to that want. It's not the, you know, we're not living in a fantasy world where want equals get. The trade-offs often, we're not well-trained in figuring out those trade-offs, especially on hiring managers, I'm afraid to say. But there's arguments to say whether they even should be hiring managers. Like, should a manager, an operating manager, be involved in the recruiting process in the as a hirer? Maybe they're just a performance manager and you get a talent acquisition person to do that part. So I think there's a further conversation to be had on there, but we don't have time to get into it right now. I want to go to the second question. This is from Michael Blakely. Do you think the Rooney Rule currently used, do you think the Rooney Rule currently used in the NFL could be introduced in the corporate world? So for the folks who don't know the Rooney Rule, I believe that this is a rule whereby when a head coaching position kind of is available, there needs to be a slate, and in the slate of candidates, there has to be a person from a marginalized background in that slate before you make the hire. So it's not saying, hey, there's a quota, you need to hire a person from this protected category or whatnot, but on the interview process, there needs to have this component. So do you think this should be introduced to the corporate world? So leaving aside technology for the time being, Markelos, let's go to you with this. Rooney Rule, yes or no?
You don't necessarily need more legislation. How is the Rooney Rule going to be much different than the 4/5 rule that the EEOC already enforces on people? It says that you have to bring people based on, you know, the percentages of the candidates that come in anyways and so on. Is it being enforced? Let me tell you, it's not. So adding more things is ineffective as long as they're not being enforced. And giving a rule that people can say, yeah, checklist, I interviewed an African-American, is not going to do anyone favors. We need to deal with the problem at its root. And the root is, how can we fix the process? How can we have everyone go through Lawrence course where they de-bias themselves and they learn how to deal with it? How can we have more tools, ideally like Brick, but similar, where we get the right talent based on what we really need? So affirmative action is great, but there is enough legislation already. Let's enforce it first, and then let's add more.
That's a really good response, Markelos. Let's finish with this one. Let's go with you, Lorne.
I think that the Candy Awards, the Candidate Experience Awards for diversity would be an awesome idea.
For diversity?
Yeah, those is the Candidate Experience Awards that, but I don't know, but if there was one for diversity where companies wanted to win that award.
I'm pretty certain there is already. I mean, I'm not aware of it, to my shame, but if anybody knows about this, then please comment on the on any of these chat screens, because I'd love to know about it. With no judgment, I'd just love to explore it and see what that looks like. And in fact, how do you measure that? You know, because that would also be another thing that's interesting to explore. Okay, Christine, final word for you. Rooney Rule, could it be introduced in the corporate world? This idea that there is on the shortlist, there has to be these types of people on the shortlist before you can make the hire.
I do agree with what Markelos is saying. I love it. To be honest, I didn't even know there was a name for it. So it's the first time I've heard of it, and I wrote it down. I think so. I think, you know, obviously it's hard to enforce it, but I think it'll be nice to strive towards it, right? And especially if you work in technology like we do, the reality is it's not very diverse. So I think as a recruiter, like, we definitely have the ability or the responsibility to at least show more diversity at the shortlisting stage, whatever happens afterwards, right? Like, you know, you anonymize the names, anonymize the CVs, etc. Whatever happens after, at least you know you've committed or at least made some change at that upper funnel. So I think there is some grounds for it to be rolled out in a corporate level. And I do agree on completely on the implementation side and, you know, legislation can it be rolled out. But I think it's a nice thing to strive towards for sure.
Yep. I'm agreeing with you on this, Christine. I think it's doable. But I also think that you're right in the sense enforcement is a problem, but perhaps it's a commitment that a corporate employers can do. And we've already seen that already in many companies kind of not waiting for the legislation and just rolling out a rule to say, okay, we're going to give this a shot. This is our commitment. And that's actually now feeding into how they communicate with the wider audience. And I'm sure there's probably benefit downstream in terms of their attractiveness as an employer and stuff like this when they're signaling these positive kind of commitments. And again, you look at the generational differences, again, striving into, you know, at risk of moving into generational stereotyping here. But let's look at some of those big chunks of people in terms of their age range. And concern for diversity basically is the inverse of how old or young people are. Mm. And the younger the people are, it's super important. So if you want to future-proof your business and future-proof your recruiting, then maybe a pre-legislation commitment of this type, even internally for your business, might actually be the best thing you can try and do. Okay. Listen, everybody, that's it for today. We're a little bit over time. I just want to thank everyone for joining me in this conversation. What a fabulous chat it was. Christine, thank you for being co-host and being the upgrade for Adam Gordon. We'll definitely have you back. Lorne Epstein, thank you very much for joining us and sharing some of your thoughts on unconscious bias training. That was fabulous. Markelos, thanks for coming in at last minute and giving us a bit of indication from the vendor side as to how we can use tooling better to achieve the aims I think we're all trying to do, which is essentially get the right people for the right jobs and do so in a fair and equitable way. That's ultimately what we're trying to do.
I always want to remind people that they should try things out. I invite everyone to try one of our free trials. Just go to brick.com, and Brick, surprisingly, is spelled B-R-Y-Q. Just to confuse people. But hey, just go do the free trial. Try it on yourself. See how well it works. And then you can apply it on candidates. Again, check it out, it's there. Not perfect, but it's so awesome.
Yeah, I've just shared it on the chat screen now. It's free to use. So you may as well give it a shot for 14 days and see how it works. Okay, folks, that's it. We are back next week with Culture Fit is Bullshit. You cannot miss this show, folks. We are talking about hiring for fit. It's actually related to this particular show, actually, because we used to recruit, I think 5 years ago, rewind the clock, culture fit was the thing. We wanted to recruit for that rather than experience. Okay, great. Actually, we didn't think about the implications on diversity. Are we just hiring for people that look and sound like us and think like us? Do we have a problem if we go this way? So it's going to be a fantastic show. We've got Nico Blia Silvestri joining us, and Jess Hayes is going to join us as well. Make sure you sign up for that. If you enjoyed this show, make sure you follow the channel. We do this every Friday. That is about it for me. So thank you very much for joining us for this. Have a good weekend, everybody. We will see you next week.
Thank you, Hung.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, Hung.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hope that was okay, everybody. If you enjoyed it, give me a thumbs up. Follow the channel. Make sure you subscribe to Brain Food, by the way. There's more cool stuff happening for you on Sunday when the newsletter comes out. Okay, cool. Have a good weekend, everybody. It's me out.